in until 2033 at the earliest. Under the deal, new fossil fuel investments will cease to be protected in the European Union and United Kingdom from mid-August of 2023. Existing fossil fuel investments in the European Union and United Kingdom would lose protection after 10 years. But the 10-year phase-out for the oil and gas only comes into force once the treaty has been ratified by three-quarters of the Energy Charter Treaty's 53 signatories. Moreover, the fossil fuel carve-out does not bind countries. While the European Union and Britain have chosen to end protection for oil and gas investments, other Energy Charter Treaty signatories such as Central Asian states, Switzerland and Japan can maintain protection for fossil fuel investors. Member countries are expected to formally approve the deal in November, but it will still need to be ratified by each capital. Amandine van der Berger, a lawyer at the non-governmental organisation Client Earth, said, "With a 10-year phase-out period for fossil fuel investments, European Union countries could still be sued for putting in place progressive climate policies for at least another decade. The key window for action if humanity is to avoid climate catastrophe." Referring to the decision to extend treaty protection to these areas, she said, "The new treaty will also open the door to a wave of financial compensation claims, protecting investments in energy sources and technologies, raising significant sustainability concerns, such as biomass, hydrogen, and carbon capture storage." Amandine van der Berger added, "The bottom line is, we are still left with a dangerous agreement that will obstruct urgent action to tackle the climate crisis for years to come. The European Union must finally do what is necessary for climate and legally right. It must walk away." France, Germany, Spain, Poland and the Netherlands have called on the European Commission to study withdrawing from the agreement. This week, Spain's Deputy Prime Minister went public with her concerns. Speaking before the outcome of negotiations was confirmed, Spain's Deputy Prime Minister Teresa Ribera said 14 rounds of talks on reforming treaty had made clear it fails to ensure the alignment of the Energy Charter Treaty with the Paris Climate Accord and the objectives of the European Green Deal. She told the website Politico it was time for the European Union and its member states to initiate a coordinated withdrawal. Her intervention cast doubt over whether the European Union can ratify the treaty, which also must be approved by the European Parliament. European Union officials say their negotiating position was endorsed by all 27 EU member states. Officials argue that withdrawing from the treaty does not protect European Union interests because investors would have a 20-year period to sue governments because of a lengthy sunset clause. The European Commission said the modernized Energy Charter Treaty preserved the right of governments to pursue their public policy objectives, including for climate change mitigation and adaptation. "This fully preserves the European Union's ability to develop our climate policies. We have thereby aligned the Energy Charter Treaty with the Paris Climate Accord and our environmental objectives." Climate activists disagree, however, contending that countries could quit the treaty and agree to protect each other from Energy Charter Treaty claims. Chloe Mikulaczek, a spokesperson for Extinction Rebellion Belgium, said, "We're talking about timeframes that could protect the benefit of the fossil fuel industry well into 2030. And the thing is, we don't have time to wait until 2030 for climate action. We need it right now. On Thursday, 23rd of June, Extinction Rebellion activists delayed the start of treaty negotiations by about an hour by gluing themselves to meeting tables before their protest was broken up by police. Outside the Brussels headquarters of the European Charter Treaty Secretariat, a few dozen activists staged a die-in, lying on the entrance steps amid fake oil, with a banner reading, "Stop protecting fossil fuel profits." Chloe Mikulaczak said they would continue to target the treaty among any policy that is harmful for the climate. The British government welcomed the agreement, saying it would protect the UK government's sovereign right to change its own energy systems to reach emissions reduction targets in line with the Paris Climate Accord. Greg Hands, the energy minister, said the United Kingdom cannot support an outdated treaty which holds back investment in clean energy and puts British taxpayers at risk from costly legal challenges.
A puppet government in the heart of Africa.
Part 1.
On August 6, 1945, some eyewitnesses were cited as saying that they had seen another sun rising in Japanese sky. There was no second sun. It was the U.S. first nuclear bomb, codenamed Little Boy, that was exploded at an altitude of 576 meters above the ground over the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, the U.S. second nuclear bomb, nicknamed Fat Man, was dropped on the people of the city of Nagasaki to once again show off America's nuclear capability to the world and its East rival. However, the U.S. Army's show of power in the last days of the Second World War resulted in the killing of 220,000 Japanese civilians. The energy emitted from the explosion of Little Boy was estimated to equal a blast caused by 16,000 tons of TNT. A horrific bomb that the Americans managed to build only because they had got access to large uranium deposits. The country through which the required uranium to build these two bombs was provided lied in the heart of the African continent and was known as the Belgian Congo. June the 30th, 1960, the people of the Congo officially celebrated independence from Belgian colonialism. High-ranking officials from the Congo and other African countries attended the official independence ceremony. The event had a special guest. The Belgian king came to the Congo to give the gift of independence to the people of the country. In the ceremony, the king hailed the unwavering and wise sacrifices made by Belgium's former king and the founder of the Congo's colonialism, Leopold II, and lauded his efforts to civilize and liberate the people of the Congo from the yoke of colonialism. The Congo is so rich in natural resources and vast deposits of mineral that it can be called a treasure island in the heart of Africa. Rivers, dense rainforests, diverse animal species, and unique underground resources, including copper, gold, uranium, coltan, and diamond. And in most cases, there is no other known example in our world to rival them. Despite its huge natural wealth, the Congo is among the world's poorest nations. This contradiction is rooted in successive calamities aimed at looting the Congo's natural treasures throughout history, which were endured by the people of this country. In the late 19th century, Belgian King Leopold II sought to keep up with European neighbors. He had to find a colony to remain in the race. Most of the world's regions that were rich in resources had been already seized by competitors at the time. Africa was the only viable option. Sponsored by Sir Henry Morton Stanley, one of his friends, Leopold tried to find a suitable land as his colony. As an explorer in the heart of Africa, Stanley traveled along the Congo River and purchased land for the Belgian king after negotiating with African tribal chiefs. He bought the lands at a very low price, for example, in exchange for some clothes. So, in the early 1880s, Leopold could turn a land spanning as much as 900,000 square miles, that is 87 times the size of Belgium, into personal property. Although the Belgian government made extensive efforts to conceal its crimes in the Congo and even destroyed certain documents and reports, the articles that were published years later by Western journalists about that era revealed that as many as half of the Congo's population had been killed during Leopold's 40-year rule, which amounts to a massacre of tens of millions of people. The days of independence dawned after years of fighting by the people of the Congo. During the battle, the voice that was more vociferous than those of others belonged to a good-looking, determined young man named Patrice Lumumba. He wanted to obliterate the legacy of Leopold, which continued to haunt his country. Lumumba was imprisoned for his anti-colonialism activities for a while, but he was elected as leader of the Congolese National Movement in 1958. A movement led by the young Lumumba, which managed to overcome ethnic and tribal differences and revive the spirit of national unity and independence seeking among millions of the Congolese people. The first coup plot in the Congo was hatched with the help of the U.S. Western allies. The state of Katanga was a rich mining region in the Congo, which had large deposits of copper, cobalt, uranium, and gold. Moise Tshombe, an old friend of Western multinational corporations, was the president of the state. Katanga proclaimed its independence and secession from the Congo only 11 days after the country's independence and staged rebellion against the central government and Prime Minister Lumumba himself. It is worth mentioning that as much as Moise Tshombe was pro-Western, he had a strange grudge against Lumumba. After Lumumba was disappointed about receiving any aid from the U.S., he had no choice but to appeal to the East superpower. Unlike the U.S., the Soviets welcomed the Congo government this time. Now they could pin the label of communist on Lumumba and his government. The Americans used this weapon in the best possible way. As the Congo was engulfed in chaos, Congolese President Joseph Kasavubu removed Lumumba from power in a dismissal order on September the 5th, just 74 days after the central government had taken office. A decision that the Prime Minister refused to accept. Lumumba went to the parliament and tried to dismiss President Kasavubu. He delivered such a fervent and reasonable speech that both the Senate and the National Assembly voted in favor of Lumumba. Under such circumstances, the Prime Minister needed to win the global public opinion, so he held a news conference with international journalists to inform the world of his stances. But some of these newspapers described him as Africa's Lenin. The Americans did not stand idle either. Since 1959, they had established a solid and reliable relation with a Congolese army officer called General Joseph Mobutu.
Joseph Mobutu.
Mobutu, who served as chief of staff of the army during the 1960 crisis, had been in constant contact with the CIA station chief in the Congo, Lawrence Devlin, all throughout the crisis. Relations between Mobutu and the CIA worked out well for them. Eventually, and just after 2 months, Joseph Mobutu staged a coup against Lumumba on September 14, 1960, and ousted his government, which was the first democratically elected one in the Congo's history. Meanwhile, the U.S. refused to issue a visa for Lumumba to attend the UN session to prevent him from addressing the world directly. Now, the Congo had two governments which both sought recognition from the UN. Surprisingly enough, Sweden's Dag Hammarskjöld, the then UN Secretary General, recognized the coup government of Joseph Mobutu. The Prime Minister's situation was getting worse day by day. Lumumba's house was besieged by UN forces. The UN forces did not even allow him to speak on the radio under the pretext that Lumumba's remarks would aggravate the crisis and would further increase tensions. The communication between the head of Congo's democratically elected government and the people was cut off. Finally, Lumumba managed to escape the UN besiege and headed with his family to the city of Stanleyville, located 2,000 kilometers north of the capital, where Lumumba's supporters were seeking to form a government alongside the coup government. Patrice Lumumba delivered speeches to the people in most of the cities and villages in his escape to the north to inform them about the facts behind the developments in the Congo. CIA agents followed Lumumba all throughout the way. They were looking for a suitable place where the coup army could arrest him. On December 1, 1960, as the Prime Minister was crossing the Sankuru River with his family, the spies announced that the time was ripe for his arrest. As Lumumba's boat approached the shore, forces loyal to the coup leader Mobutu got into the boat. Lumumba was taken to the capital aboard a plane, but those who accompanied him forgot that he was the Prime Minister until just a few days ago. Patrice Lumumba arrived at the airport of Leopold, which was full of reporters. They showed the Prime Minister to the public in a very humiliating and offensive way, a move which was planned to tarnish his charismatic image. His wife and children were witnesses to what was happening at the airport some meters away. Lumumba, along with two of his cabinet ministers, Maurice Ampolo and Joseph Okito, were sent to the state of Katanga to be executed. Moise Tshombe, Lumumba's archenemy, was looking forward to receiving his guest. On June 17, 1961, the Katanga government, led by Moise Tshombe and supported by Belgian advisors, decided that Patrice Lumumba and his two accompanying ministers should be executed. At around 8:30 p.m., the prisoners were taken to a place in the depth of a remote forest to be executed. Moise Tshombe was present in the place along with his ministers. The soldiers shot Lumumba and his companions dead and then rolled their bodies into a ditch. The coup government spread a rumor in an attempt to answer to the public opinion. The rumor was that Lumumba had escaped in a stolen car and was later arrested and killed by local people. However, the people of the Congo never believed this official account of the incident. The true story about the abduction and execution of Lumumba was leaked after several years. But Lumumba's body could also be highly problematic. He was so popular that the discovery of his body could put his murderers into trouble. Therefore, they decided to exhume and destroy the bodies. The mission was delegated to a Belgian officer called Gerard Sauté. They returned to the place where the bodies had been buried. They exhumed the bodies and after drinking a lot of alcohol, they dismembered the bodies and dissolved them in sulfuric acid. After years of conflict and civil war, Joseph Mobutu wrested full control over the Congo in 1965. After that, Mobutu, who called himself Mobutu Sese Seko, ruled over the Congo for 32 years with an iron fist. He even changed the name of the Congo to Zaire. With Mobutu's seizing of power, the U.S. had found a puppet government in the heart of the strategic continent of Africa for three decades.
Well, Zaire is among America's oldest friends, and its president, President Mobutu, one of our most valued friends. The entire continent of Africa. And we are proud and very, very pleased to have you with us today. Thank you, sir.
Mobutu was one of the world's wealthiest men until 1997, with a fortune estimated as much as $5 billion, while the Congo's population of 40 million had been degraded to one of the world's poorest nations.
Mobutu was ousted from power in 1997 by Laurent Kabila, a leader of one of the main rebel groups. He later died of cancer in Morocco. During the civil wars that ensued Mobutu's fall, some 5.5 million of the Congolese people were killed, while millions of others were displaced. 9 African countries and 20 militia groups were involved in the wars, which are remembered as the African World War. Civil war, violence, disease, hunger and poverty were the legacy of the colonialist rule of Belgian King Leopold II, as well as the involvement of the White House rulers in overthrowing the only democratically elected and popular government in this green land. Although in 2002, the Belgian government apologized to the Congolese people for the involvement of its forces in deposing and killing Patrice Lumumba, the U.S. government has yet to apologize for architecting and launching the Congo coup and contributing to Patrice Lumumba's assassination.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Military posturing in the Asia-Pacific also risks nuclear war and the potential extinction of the human species, says Anne Wright, former U.S. diplomat who resigned in March 2003 in opposition to the war on Iraq, in an article published under the heading Largest ever U.S.-NATO naval war drills in Pacific, a threat to both peace and marine life. Stay tuned for more. While the world's attention is focused on the crisis in Eastern Europe, halfway around the world in the Pacific Ocean, confrontation of the US and NATO toward China and North Korea is taking an increasingly military turn. The US military's Indo-Pacific Command, headquartered in Honolulu, Hawaii, Rim of the Pacific, or RIMPAC 2022, military war games will have 38 ships from 26 countries, 4 submarines, 170 aircraft, and 25,000 military personnel practicing naval war maneuvers in the Hawaiian waters from June 29th to August 4th, 2022. Additionally, ground units from 9 countries will come ashore on the islands of Hawaii in amphibious landings. Many citizens of the 26 RIMPAC countries do not agree with their country's participation in the RIMPAC war games, calling them provocative and dangerous for the region. The Pacific Peace Network, with members from countries and islands across the Pacific, including Guam, Jeju Island, South Korea, Okinawa, Japan, Philippines, Northern Mariana Islands, Aotearoa, in New Zealand, Australia, Hawaii, and the United States, demand that RIMPAC be cancelled, calling the naval armada dangerous, provocative, and very destructive. The network's petition for cancellation of RIMPAC states that RIMPAC dramatically contributes to the destruction of the ecology system and aggravation of the climate crisis in the Pacific region. RIMPAC war forces will blow up decommissioned ships with missiles, endangering marine mammals such as humpback whales, dolphins, and Hawaiian monk seals, and polluting the ocean with contaminants from the vessels. Land forces will conduct ground assaults that will tear up beaches where green sea turtles come to breed. The petition rejects the massive expenditure of funds on war-making when humanity is suffering from lack of food, water, and other life-sustaining elements. Human security is not based on military war drills, but on care for the planet and its inhabitants. Other citizen groups in the Pacific region are adding their voices to the call to cancel RIMPAC. In its statement about RIMPAC, the Hawaii-based Women's Voices, Women Speak declared that RIMPAC causes ecological devastation, colonial violence, and gun worship. RIMPAC's ship sinking, missile testing, and torpedo blasting have destroyed island ecosystems and distributed sea creatures' well-being. This convening of military personnel promotes toxic masculinity, sex trafficking, and violence against local populations. In a June 14, 2022 opinion piece in the Honolulu Star Advertiser, the only statewide newspaper in Hawaii, three local activists with the Hawaii Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines wrote, "We are one with the people of Hawaii in opposing the U.S.-led wars for which Balikatan, U.S.-Philippine ground war maneuvers, and RIMPAC are warm-ups. As it is, the governments bring together the people of Hawaii and the people of the Philippines to prepare for war, death, and destruction. Military posturing in the Asia-Pacific also risks nuclear war and the potential extinction of the human species. We must instead work toward global cooperation to address the threat of climate change and biodiversity loss to build toward peace, life, and coexistence," unquote. The citizens' petition to cancel RIMPAC has individual signatures and organizational endorsers from around the world. ...2022 RIMPAC includes military forces from Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Colombia, Denmark, Ecuador, France, Germany, India, Indonesia, the Zionist regime, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, Netherlands, New Zealand, Peru, the Republic of Korea, the Republic of the Philippines, Singapore, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Tonga, the UK, and the US. 40% of RIMPAC participants are either in NATO or have NATO ties. 6 of the 26 RIMPAC countries are members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, including Canada, Denmark, France, Germany, the UK, and the US. while four other participating countries are Asia-Pacific partners of NATO, including Australia, Japan, South Korea, and New Zealand. In the Pacific, NATO forces coming into the region greatly increased the tension with China and North Korea. Military-naval events, both in practice and in war, are dangerous for humans and for marine mammals. Scores of dolphins have turned up dead on the coast of the Black Sea from that war. The intense ship noise and low-frequency sonars interfere with the dolphins' main means of communication. Disruptive underwater noises may either have them end up losing their way in large fishing nets or around the Black Sea shores. The Turkish Marine Research Foundation announced recently that more than 80 dolphins were found dead across the country's western Black Sea coast, an extraordinary increase in the number of marine mammals found dead in a typical year. A recent video from the Black Sea documents some of the 80 dead dolphins. Several studies in the past have confirmed that military sonars are harmful to marine life, and many militaries have adopted mitigating measures to protect wildlife. Whales and dolphins have been killed in U.S. military war exercises by sonars and bombs. In March 2000, the U.S. Navy admitted that its use of a high-intensity sonar system caused 16 beaked and mink whales to be stranded on beaches in Bahama shortly after U.S. Navy ships using high-intensity sonar had passed by. Six of the whales died, and autopsies on the mammals revealed bleeding around the whale's inner ears and, in one instance, in the brain. 10 whales were pushed back into the sea, but a declining sightings of beaked whales led researchers working in the area to believe that many more may have died. The Navy and the National Marine Fisheries Service, NMFS, launched a series of investigations with the interim synopsis of the reports concluding that the bleeding was caused by sound waves produced by high-intensity sonar. With almost twice as many military ships arriving in the Hawaiian waters than the Russian Navy has in the Black Sea, the dangerous effects of the RIMPAC war maneuvers on dolphins, whales, and fishes will be substantial. The effect of RIMPAC military war exercises on international relations in the Pacific region may also have dangerous, intended or unintended consequences that could put the region into ever-increasing military confrontation instead of dialogue. Major cities in Asia, including Beijing, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Seoul, Tokyo, Pyongyang and Moscow, could be targeted and destroyed by ballistic missiles from the U.S. and NATO. In the United States, Honolulu, Haganta, Guam, Washington, D.C., New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, Seattle, Houston could be targeted by missiles from other countries. Cities in Europe, including London, Paris, Rome, Madrid, Amsterdam, could be damaged or destroyed. Military responses to perceived national security issues by any of the countries in the region, whether it be North Korea, China, Russia, or the United States, will be disastrous for peoples over the entire planet. Experts must not let the governments continue confrontation instead of dialogue to resolve national security issues. The lives of people around the world are at stake. Experts must not let those who make money and political status out of war win again and start another horrific war for peace.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, is not just expanding towards the Russian border, an issue that is one of the causes of the current war in Ukraine. Now, this U.S.-led military alliance is also expanding its hegemony in Africa under the pretext of supporting the African Union in its peacekeeping missions. A NATO official speaks here after the signing of an agreement with the African Union officials in 2019.
The signing ceremony that we've just had is a really significant event. It is a technical agreement between NATO and between the African Union, and this will allow us now to expand our political and our practical cooperation.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on NATO's expansion in Africa and how the presence of this U.S.-led military alliance is spreading instability in Africa. Our analyst will be speaking on some of the covert objectives of NATO in Africa. In the second segment of our program, we shall see how Chad is the latest African country to witness anti-France protests. We're asking, why are Chadians angry with France? Stay with us as our experts give us their take on these topics, and please send your comments through our social media handle.
NATO expansion in Africa. NATO is a treaty organization created in 1949 by the United States to maintain its military and political power over Europe. Since the early years of its existence, this U.S.-led military organization established covert and overt military operations in Africa during the Cold War. NATO set up the Allied Forces Southern Europe, AFSOUTH, in Naples in 1951, and then the Allied Forces Mediterranean, AFMED, in Malta in 1952. Western powers established these military formations to garrison the Mediterranean Sea against the Soviet Navy and to create platforms from where they could militarily intervene in the African continent. NATO's war in Libya was its first major military operation in Africa. Former dictator Muammar Gaddafi was toppled from power after a popular uprising in 2011, which was hijacked by NATO through an imperialist military intervention. NATO interference in Libya without the approval of the African Union plunged the country into chaos.
Former Zimbabwean President, the late Robert Mugabe, in his 2012 address at the general debate of the 67th session of the General Assembly of the United Nations, months after Gaddafi was toppled, warned of NATO expansion in Africa.
Mr. President, we recognize that there are existing and emerging threats and challenges that continue to frustrate our individual and collective efforts to attain greater economic development and social progress, as well as peace and security. But the increasing trend by the NATO states, inspired by the arrogant belief that they are the most powerful among us, which has demonstrated itself through their recent resort to unilateralism and military hegemony in Libya, is the very antithesis of the basic principles of the United Nations. In that case of Libya, the African Union and its peacemaking role was defied, ignored, and humiliated.
Well, for more on NATO's expansion in Africa, we have contacted John Philpott, an international human rights lawyer. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time today.
Well, thank you, and it's very nice to talk about world problems, especially in 2022.
Now, what is NATO really pursuing through its out-of-area operations in Africa, a continent which poses no existential threat to this Western military alliance?
Well, NATO shouldn't really exist, since it was formed to fight communism and the Eastern Bloc folded in 1990. NATO serves to be a U.S. military and political instrument to exercise U.S. power. And whether someone poses a threat or not to NATO in Europe is not the question which one has to ask. It's whether or not the U.S. can promote its strategic and economic and political interests militarily. And obviously, the U.S. is under threat of rivalry. There's kind of a non-aligned movement being born in Africa. And NATO, as the political and military branch of the United States, will attempt to be involved in Africa, as we saw in Libya in 2011.
Well, as Mr. Philpott mentioned there, a classic case of NATO meddling in Africa is Libya. NATO and the United States led the destruction of Libya in 2011, and the aftermath of that was instability in North Africa and the entire Sahel region.
What's the interest of NATO in the Sahel, especially considering the fact instability continues to plague the region despite the presence of military forces from NATO member states?
The question which one has to ask, and asking the question provides the answer, does the U.S. or NATO like countries to be balkanized or fragmentized? And the answer is yes. And the first, in the last generation, the most important example is Yugoslavia, which was broken up. They like fragmented countries. There's been an attempt to, in the last 30 years, to break up the Congo, and U.S. think tanks want the Congo to break up. It's a country of, I think, 95 million.
Kwame Nkrumah warned in 1967 that there were at least 17 NATO air bases, 9 naval bases, 3 intercontinental ballistic missile launch sites, and 1 nuclear test site in North Africa. Now, has the situation worsened in terms of NATO presence and militarization of Africa since Nkrumah's warning?
Yes. Well, the U.S. established under George Bush in 2008, 2007 and 8, the African Command. It's called AFRICOM, which is ironically based in Germany, but it has 29, I think, bases in 15 different countries, and there's operational work being done in other countries. And the U.S. is into almost every African country. Their biggest base is in Djibouti, and some countries have refused, like Eritrea, Zimbabwe, and I think there's other ones. So the U.S. is omnipresent in Africa, ostensibly to fight terrorism, but the reason is U.S. strategic interests, in my opinion.
Last May, British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace and Spanish Defense Minister Margarita Robles addressed a joint press conference in Madrid and claimed that Russia's expanding influence and activity in Africa pose a worrying threat to the security of NATO countries. However, despite pressure from Western countries, the African Union chairperson, President Macky Sall of Senegal, visited Russia recently and met President Vladimir Putin in the southwestern Russian city of Sochi, and explained Africa's position regarding the conflict in Ukraine.
You have seen the different votes at the United Nations. The position of Africa, despite enormous pressure, the majority of African countries have avoided condemning this situation.
For his part, President Putin said Russia will continue to develop ties with African countries.
Our country has always been on the side of Africa, has always supported Africa in its battle against colonialism. We think that with Africa in general and its individual nations, we traditionally have very good relations. I would even call them friendly relations without exaggeration. Africa as a whole has a huge potential, and based on that, we will continue to develop our relationships with Africa and its individual nations.
Now, with the growing influence of China and Russia in Africa, are we going to see increased NATO presence in the continent, and is there a likelihood of a flare-up between these global rivals in Africa?
my understanding and what I read is that the Russian way of working in Africa is different. Similarly, there's a lot of relationships with China, and China's building infrastructures, and it has fairer relationships with Africa. There are difficulties, of course. Those are called, that's called bilateral problems, and there's been a lot of negotiation and improvement of relationships with China. So, and I guess I'm from Canada. Canada's a mining country. Toronto is the center of mining. They do not negotiate. They impose contracts with 15-year limits on arbitration, and they go into countries, mine them out, leave all the refuse, the leftover mining slag and things like that, make people get sick from different types of illnesses related to the mining, and walk away from it.
Now, lack of a strong African military force ready to enforce peace remains a major challenge, and this has made the continent vulnerable to Western imperialist powers. Now, how can African countries disentangle themselves from dependency on Western military assistance in maintaining peace and security in the continent?
Well, I mean, it comes down to AFRICOM out of Africa, U.S. out of Africa, which is a bit simplistic, but national sovereignty is very important, and they have to look, countries will have to look out for their interests and negotiate on a country-to-country basis for their development and refuse the dictates of the United States. And you are, your country has been under U.S. dictates. We can see how the U.S. does not negotiate. They impose. They try and force a country to accept their point of view. And that can't go on.
Well, the onus is on African countries to resist U.S. dictates. That's what our guest for today, John Philpott, says. We'd like to thank him for his insight on NATO's expansion in Africa. Our next topic for today is on the recent anti-French demonstrations in Chad. But before that discussion, we shall take a short break, so stay with us.
Nigerian Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, Ambassador Zubairu Dada, recently visited Iran, leading a high-ranking delegation to participate in the 6th Iran-Nigeria Joint Commission. The event saw the two sides signing multiple cooperation documents envisaging cooperation in tourism, oil, agriculture, and sports. During his visit to Iran, the Nigerian Minister of State for Foreign Affairs paid a visit to the Saipa Group, a major Iranian automaker. Speaking to Press TV after visiting the Saipa factory, the Nigerian minister said he was fascinated by what he saw.
Wonderful experience of learning what it is that the Iranians are doing and doing for themselves and for the nation. I'm very much fascinated, and I believe all members of my team are just as fascinated with what we've seen.
On the tremendous technological advancement in Iran despite sanctions, the Nigerian minister said sanctions have enabled Iran to look inwards.
It's the mother of invention, isn't it? I guess what the sanctions have done is to make sure, I mean, the Iranians look inwards and to challenge themselves to find out what it is that they can do from within and to do for themselves.
On trade between Iran and Nigeria, the Nigerian foreign minister says the trend is upward, but it's still far from satisfactory.
And from the little that we've been able to see, I mean, I'm convinced there is a lot that we can do together. And what that means, of course, is that through this collaboration, we can up, as it were, our game, up the ante, and, you know, raise the volume of trade between our two countries.
Anti-French protests in Chad.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Italians have taken to the streets recently in several anti-French protests called by the country's opposition leaders.
Angry protesters expressed their opposition to France's military presence in the country and support for transitional president Mohamed Idriss Déby Itno, who has been in power since his father, Idriss Déby Itno, was killed by rebels in April 2021.
A member of an opposition coalition speaks here during a protest against France in Chad.
What right do they have to accept that French people who are not accepted in West Africa have the right to come back here? By what right? Nobody knows about it. If they are strong as that, they can go and make war in Ukraine.
Now, to discuss the anti-France sentiments in Chad, we have contacted Inem Richardson, the co-founder of Thomas Sankara Center for African Liberation and Unity. She's also an organizer with the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Thanks, madam, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Now, why are the people of Chad opposed to the presence of French troops in the country?
Well, one thing you have to realize is that it's not just the people of Chad, but really all across West and Central Africa, especially in the Sahel, French troops are seen as a form of military occupation. If you look at the history of the region, since the late 50s, early 60s, France signed really dark and really manipulative neocolonial contracts that granted the country permission to intervene militarily in the region. Which they've done time and time again. So if you look at, you know, throughout the entire region, we see that France was just recently kicked out of Mali, but they have a strong presence here in Burkina Faso, they have a presence in Niger, they have a military base in Dakar, even though Dakar tends not to be oftentimes thought of or included in this conversation. So all across the region, France is seen as not just a former colonial power, but a neo-colonial power, and one that's never really changed its role in the region very much.
Chad's military transition is struggling to win over a population exhausted by 30 years of French-backed autocratic rule. Anti-French sentiment is usually high among protesters, who blame France for backing the current and previous military regimes against the will of the people. Why is the French government supporting President Mohamed Idriss Déby Itno, who has been in power undemocratically since his father's assassination in 2021?
Well, France doesn't just support undemocratic leaders in its former colonies and across the African continent. France actually directly installs various governments that France knows will serve its interests. So for decades, France had a very close relationship with Idriss Déby, and now that former President Idriss Déby has passed, France is now backing his son, current transition president, Mahatma Déby. See, if we look at across this whole region, even just next door in Cameroon, we see a very similar legacy that France has left behind, where after killing the Cameroonian revolutionaries in the UPC, France